Kia ora and welcome to The Week in Review. I'm Paul Brennan with a selection of stories and interviews in RNZ News this week. Coming up in this podcast, convicted child sex offender Peter Ellis has been granted leave to appeal his case at the Supreme Court. Speak Up for Women urges government to intervene over trans athletes. And Baldwin Street's battle to be recognised as the world's steepest street isn't over yet.
If you're doing a road long section, you prepare it, you show the centreline finish level, and that's what you use to show your road gradients.
Coming up in The Week in Review. But first, National has put the Health Minister on the back foot, unveiling a plan to combat cancer weeks before the government is set to announce its own strategy. National leader Simon Bridges used the party's annual conference to launch the policy, promising to set up an independent cancer agency and a dedicated fund for cancer treatments. Not only does it borrow from Labor's pre-election promises, it puts pressure on the government to follow through or look like it's breaking its word. Our deputy political editor, Craig McCulloch, was at last weekend's conference in Christchurch. He filed this for Monday's morning report.
A bold push into Labor territory, gazumping the government at its own game.
As Prime Minister, I will not stand by and watch people die when we have the opportunity to do more. And that's why the next National Government will fund and dedicate an extra $200 million for PharmAct to fund cancer drugs.
Simon Bridges receiving a standing ovation from National's members, a promise of more money to fight cancer, and a swipe at those in power too.
I'm sick of reading in the newspaper that people are going without life-saving drugs. When I see this government wasting billions and billions of dollars on policies that do not work and do not improve the well-being of New Zealanders.
It's hard to argue against more support for cancer treatment, and for Troy Elliott in the audience, the policy's deeply personal. His wife Tracy has been battling the disease for 5 years. It's cost them $500,000. They're putting their house on the market today. Tracy's currently on a drug called Kadcyla, which costs $9,000 every 3 weeks.
We've got the battle to survive and to live, and to have the extra battle to actually find money to pay for that as well is a strain that families shouldn't have to go through, and it's heartbreaking.
PharmAct spends about $200 million annually on cancer medicines. National would top that up by another $50 million a year for 4 years. That funding would have to be spent on cancer treatments or else returned to the government's coffers. Studies have failed to find evidence that a similar cancer fund in the United Kingdom was effective, with research showing it's resulted in unproven treatments being funded. But Mr. Bridges says that won't happen here.
New Zealanders are not getting the proven ones, the ones all around the world that have been shown to work and would enable New Zealanders to live longer, better lives.
National's also promised to set up an independent cancer agency within 100 days of taking power, a policy almost directly lifted from Labor's pre-election promises and one the government's yet to deliver. Momentum for such an agency is growing. A petition with some 140,000 signatures was handed to Parliament last week. And yet recently, the Health Minister David Clark appears to have gone cold on the idea. He promises he'll lay out his full cancer plan in the coming weeks.
We owe it to the people living with cancer to get it right. I'm not going to be rushed to make announcements immediately following an on-the-hoof policy from National, but very soon we will be making our announcements so that we can address the problems that we as a government have inherited.
As for the opposition's proposal, he's sceptical, pointing out that National scrapped an independent advisory committee on cancer in 2015.
People don't trust National on healthcare, and I'm concerned that it might actually be giving people false hope.
National's gambit has backed Dr. Clark into a corner. Labor either breaks its promise or risks looking like National's forced its hand. The pledge is also in line with the opposition's conference slogan and this year's key objective.
Our bottom line is you. Thank you very much.
Making politics personal.
That's our deputy political editor, Craig McCulloch, on Morning Report. And the acting Prime Minister, Winston Peters, says National's cancer plan would only pay for 2 extra drugs, and the party is exploiting the misery of patients. Winston Peters hit out Monday at National, outlining the party's record on cancer while in government.
July 8, 2015, you recall, Mr. Coleman said at that time, being the Minister of Health, presumably in consultation with his colleagues, at that time he said the NC was no longer needed. So if you think that their statements on the weekend have any integrity, you go right ahead. But I think it's shameless that people's misery, woe and death are being used in this way. And we'll make an announcement within a matter of weeks to show that we regard this matter deadly seriously. And there's clear indication that the National Party decided that they were going to gazump it with some guesswork over the weekend. They made an announcement, and with the greatest respect, do any of you know what it means? How many people? Where? When? What drugs? Not a word of detail whatsoever. We've been working on this for a long, long time, and we're still going to work on it. And so in that context, of course we support the idea of a serious refocus with respect to cancer. But the government has been working on it for months now and was only a matter of weeks away from making its announcement when the National Party at its conference thought that they would make that statement. Enough money to cover just two drugs. Can I just say, you know, that I think Pharmac's about 4.2 of our health budget. Now, in some countries, it's twice that. And so the big issue that we've got to concern ourselves with is what can we afford and how can we get the best return for our dollar. But it's right. And it's been, but it's rather sad that some of the statements that the National Party have made also would compromise any negotiation on the cost of drugs, which I regard as a demonstration of their lack of commercial common sense.
Acting Prime Minister Winston Peters, as heard on Monday's Checkpoint program. And Pharmac says it funded 4 new cancer medicines last year, with 16 new medicines funded over the previous 6 years. In a statement, its Director of Operations, Lisa Williams, says the amount of money Pharmac spends on cancer medicines has been increasing every year and is now $220 million gross. And she says it's important to remember that cancer medicines are just one tool for treatment. The majority of cancers are controlled using surgery and radiotherapy. The face of the Ihumato occupation has met with the Māori Development Minister over the Māori land dispute in South Auckland. Pania Newton says her hui with Nanaia Mahuta, a bid to break the protest deadlock, went well. Our Māori News correspondent Lee Marama McLaughlin filed this report for Wednesday's Checkpoint program.
Minister Mahuta set off from Wellington this morning to catch up with Pania Newton. She's been a leader of an activist group which has been occupying Ihumato for years to stop a Fletcher housing development. But she met with the minister today as a designated spokesperson for the local Makaurau Marae. Late this afternoon, she said it was a positive and constructive hui and that they would be meeting again at a later date. Kelly Francis, who has been occupying Ihumato for 18 months, says progress is happening.
Now that there's actually movement and we do have politicians who are coming in and wanting to kōrero with pāns, it's great. It is great. But me being me and always wanting more and always pushing boundaries, I still think that it is most respectful if Jacinda herself was to turn up.
The Prime Minister remains in the Tokelau Islands, but ministers have been meeting with various groups involved in the dispute since Friday, when she put a hold on construction while discussions are held. The Acting Prime Minister, Kelvin Davis, made a quick overnight trip to Auckland yesterday to meet with stakeholders, but his office says it is a fluid and delicate situation and would not go into details. Ms Francis says those at Ihumato have been underestimated, and she's confident that they'll get a good result.
There's absolutely room for compromise, but the reality of it is that at this moment we have the upper hand. We have definitely got the upper hand. We have access to this land. It's kind of like we've taken over jurisdiction of the road, but also the whenua. We most definitely have the upper hand, and I don't think we're in a position to negotiate until we can ensure the safety of all of our people and ensure the whakamana of the hui.
The hui or occupation at Ihumato is in its 8th day since police tried to evict them. Even with the cold and rain, a couple hundred people have been milling around throughout the day. This morning, Pania Newton said the police presence was changing, but it's clear the trust is not there.
They're reducing their numbers. They're now actually coming on our side to make sure we don't get hassled. But that doesn't mean to say that we should be relaxed. They are still representatives of the Crown.
Finding a way forward won't be easy. The mandated Te Kawerau Maki Iwi Authority wants the housing development to go ahead, as does the Kingitanga. Prominent Auckland Māori leader Rangi McLean arrived today to show his support for the protest. He says the iwi authority has mana wenua status, but so do some of those at the protest, and they should get a say.
I actually believe, based on the knowledge and teachings passed on to me by my two elders, that we should be listening to the ahika mana whenua, and I mentioned te ahi wadu. Yeah.
So those are the people here as well?
Yeah, te ahi wadu is the ahika mana whenua this area, of this land.
He says it's not uncommon for iwi members to contest an iwi mandate, and the dispute won't be easy to resolve. This afternoon, the Māori King Tuheitia announced he will visit Ihu Matau on Saturday. Mr McLean says the Kingitanga has asked local leaders for help.
That is one of the reasonings behind the Kingitanga stance as well, is that they've asked the Kei o te Waka, which includes all of us that are here in Tāmaki, elders and that, to try and mend the rift between the younger generation and the older generation. And that's something that we've got to work through.
But one landowner here, Mere, who has lived down the road for 71 years, says an important voice is also missing. She owns 3 acres of land at the edge of the proposed development site, and she thinks the landowners should be part of the resolution process.
I don't mind the protest, but how it's been handled is totally different. Like we're irrelevant, you know, like we're no one. Landowners should be spoken to more instead of being left out. We have rights too. We pay rates, we pay water.
A planned protest outside Fletcher headquarters in Auckland today saw a strong security and police presence in the early afternoon, but it did not go ahead. Perhaps a sign of progress in a complex dispute that's evolving by the day.
That's our Māori Issues correspondent Lee Marama McLaughlin on Checkpoint. Convicted child sex offender Peter Ellis has been granted leave to appeal his case at the Supreme Court. The 61-year-old, who now has terminal cancer, was jailed for 10 years for abusing 7 children at the Christchurch Civic Creche in 1991. He served 7 years of that sentence but has always maintained his innocence. 16 charges were originally laid against him based on the testimony of preschoolers. 3 of those charges were overturned in 1994 after one of the children said she lied. Mr. Ellis's lawyer, Rob Harrison, spoke to Checkpoint producer Bridget Burke.
I've just been advised that we have been granted leave to appeal and to appeal out of time. I haven't had a chance to read the decision yet because I'm not near my office, but I have spoken with Peter concerning that. I think this is extremely good news for him. It's certainly given us all a boost and means that we've got a lot of work to do between now and the hearing, but at least we're going to have a hearing, which is fantastic. Until I've seen exactly what the Supreme Court has said, I can't really advance matters, but I'm sure the first thing that we'll be looking at is the mechanics and what issues that need to be discussed. Until I've seen the decision, I'm not in a position to accurately describe to you what the next step is.
That's Peter Ellis's lawyer, Rob Harrison, speaking to producer Bridget Burke on Wednesday's Checkpoint program. A key piece of evidence in the Supreme Court case is a study looking into how the child witnesses were interviewed by police. Professor Felicity Goodyear-Smith from Auckland University is a specialist in interviewing children in sex abuse cases and a longtime supporter of Peter Ellis. She joined Corin Dan on Thursday's Morning Report.
20 years on, what has changed in the research that has prompted this?
I think more and more research has been done on the reliability or otherwise of children's testimony and the types of things that might interfere with the child's ability to recall, or in fact suggestive information that may be incorporated in their memory processes, and they come to believe things happened that didn't. And there's been a large amount of research done in the last 20 years on that.
But why now? What's changed in the last year or so to justify and to give the Supreme Court the confidence to have another look?
I think they probably could have had another look a little bit earlier than this, but, you know, he has already had two appeals. I think now the urgency is the fact that he's dying, but I think, you know, possibly 2 or 3 years ago, another appeal could have been called. I think the other thing that has occurred is that actually the Innocence Project has been spending hundreds of hours looking at the testimony of the children and the transcripts of their interviews. And I suspect that will also form part of the evidence for the appeal.
And what did it find in terms of the looking at it? Because it looked at a previous case in the US, didn't it, and compared them. What sort of patterns did it find there that perhaps it felt was questionable?
Well, look, I haven't seen the recent information from the Innocence Project, but I do know that there were many cases, particularly the McMartin's case in the US 20 years ago, where these sort of allegations occurred in crash cases, and there was a pattern. And the pattern was that someone believed a child had been abused. Children actually gave no initial testimony to say this, but the interviewing process inadvertently fed information into the children's recall, and they subsequently, all that post-event information became their reality. And children can't easily differentiate between what they experience and what they hear about. And so the testimony of the children became more and more detailed, more and more bizarre, more and more horrific sounding, and led to charges.
And one of the points made in the academic paper is that detail doesn't necessarily mean accuracy.
No, it doesn't. And there's no way for an expert to be able to determine whether a child's story is accurate or partly fabricated or completely unreal. And the more you interview them, usually the more details that will come up. And they may be true details, but they may just as easily be completely fabricated details or that have come from some other experience that the child has heard about and been told about.
So what seems to have happened here over the last few years is that the scientific consensus around these very complex issues of interviewing children in sexual abuse cases has changed in a way that gives people more confidence to question perhaps the way it was done 20 years ago.
I think so, but I think that, you know, particularly in the scientific community, the research community, it's become incredibly clear that basing a conviction purely on a child's testimony, particularly when there has been a number of suggestive interviews that have taken place, is incredibly unsafe. And it's not just unsafe, clearly, for the person who gets wrongfully, convicted. It's incredibly damaging for the children who come to believe that these terrible things happened to them when they didn't.
Just very quickly, is this an important case in general? Obviously very important for Peter Ellis, but for the country, for the justice system, in terms of the way in which interviews are looked at?
I think it's incredibly important. I mean, they had over 100 of these cases in the United States, and within a few years, they were all actually overturned. And, you know, New Zealand had this particular case, and it was never overturned. And I think, you know, the miscarriages of justice and all the implications of what it means for interviewing children and expert psychological opinion in our courts makes this an incredibly important case, way beyond the reason that we need to clear Peter's name.
That's Professor Felicity Goodyear-Smith from Auckland University, a specialist in interviewing children in sex abuse cases and a longtime supporter of Peter Ellis, speaking on Morning Report. Another longtime supporter of Peter Ellis says the Supreme Court's decision to hear his appeal is a win for justice, but they will need to hurry up. Former National Party leader Don Brash campaigned for a Royal Commission of Inquiry into Ellis's case. He joined Susie Ferguson.
Do you know why there's been such a significant time delay on this case?
I don't, I'm afraid. So many times this matter has gone before the court or the government, and again and again and again it's been deferred. I don't understand why that's the case. I think anyone who's read Lindy Hood's book on this case is convinced of his innocence. I mean, so many things went wrong in the original trial. You mentioned that I campaigned on this in 2003, indeed with Catherine Rich, and we ran a petition which attracted support from across the political spectrum. I mean, David Parker, who of course is now Attorney General, signed the petition. Judith Collins signed it, Chris Finlayson signed it, David Longy signed it, Mike Moore signed it. People from all walks of life, 11 law professors signed it, and law professors don't lightly sign petitions of that kind. So I think there's a widespread feeling that an injustice took place, that Peter was wrongly convicted, and I just hope the Supreme Court can reach a decision on this before he passes away.
The Crown's position, though, is that a 20-year delay is inordinate and unexplained. There was no explanation as to why leave wasn't filed earlier. Is that likely to run into problems? Will that become a problem at the Supreme Court?
I don't know the answer to that question. But certainly, of course, there have been, in that 20-year period, a number of cases where he's gone back in an attempt. I think the Court of Appeal did hear a hearing. He's been keen to get legal aid to go to the Privy Council. He was still able to do that because this alleged offence took place while New Zealand was still able to take cases to the Privy Council. I mean, it's not that nothing's happened in the last 20 years, but nothing effective has happened, obviously.
Why should this be treated with such urgency? Is it simply because of his medical condition?
I think that's right. I mean, it's such a widespread feeling that an injustice was done to him. I think most people feel, well, if that really is true, and let's establish whether it's true or not, but if it's true, for Pete's sake, let's get the decision, and I didn't mean that as a pun, before the man passes away.
Indeed, and with this situation, because of this time, should it be expedited? Is there some sort of way of making sure that the hearing is one that happens swiftly?
I don't know how the Supreme Court works. I mean, traditionally, Supreme Courts don't act with great expedition, and that's entirely appropriate in most cases. I certainly hope they can deal with this quickly because, as media reports suggest, he may have only 3 months to live.
You've become rather a campaigner, I suppose, a supporter of him. Have you ever met him?
Once, quite briefly, at a public meeting way back. I haven't met him in recent years.
That's the former National Party leader who campaigned for a Royal Commission of Inquiry into Peter Ellis's case, Don Brash, speaking on Thursday's Morning Report program. Stop stealing Māori children. That was the stark message delivered to politicians on the steps of Parliament on Tuesday by several hundred protesters who called for an immediate end to the uplift of Māori kids. The Hands Off Our Tamariki network handed an open letter signed by more than 17,000 people to Green Party co-leader Marama Davidson, demanding control be handed back to Māori. Three inquiries are now underway into Oranga Tamariki's uplifts of children after an investigation into the attempted uplift of a newborn in Hawke's Bay Hospital. Since 2013, there has been a 20% increase in the number of Māori babies uplifted by the state. Our reporter Marnie Dunlop was at the rally in Wellington and filed this for Checkpoint.
Several hundred protesters braved rainy weather in Wellington to take their message to Parliament, demanding that uplifts of Māori children end immediately. Those at the rally, run by the Hands Off Our Tamariki network, shared their stories of children being taken from whānau and the intergenerational trauma it has caused. One mother, Stephanie, came to the march because she faced what she called an unnecessary 5-year battle in the family court because of Oranga Tamariki. She says her children were eventually returned to her, but they were broken and devastated children. She wants the government to listen to the concerns of parents like her.
I want to see evidence, solid evidence, put before courts before any orders are made. Everybody deserves a chance.
Another protester, Lizzie Strickett, who works in maternal care research, was there to support Māori midwives.
This isn't a new fight. Māori midwives have been doing this for over 100 years to keep whānau protected. And I think that those within our system who are talking about this being a service issue or a broken system, this is incorrect. You know, this system was designed this way. It was designed to oppress and disconnect our whānau from one another. And no more, you know, our whānau are our model of health. They are the system that we need to be preserving and protecting.
The open letter calls on the government to stop stealing Māori children from their whakapapa and asks for the ministry in charge to be overhauled and restructured in line with kaupapa Māori. Orangatamariki came under renewed scrutiny this year after the attempted uplift of a newborn from its mother at Hawke's Bay Hospital. Jean Te Huia was one of the midwives at the centre of that case. She says Orangatamariki's policies are racist and it is continuing to hurt iwi and hapū.
When we look at the statistics of children in state care today, they're third, fourth and fifth generation. So some of them are telling me that their children, they are children of state care, their parents were and their grandparents were, and to me it looks like they're targeted. So we have intergenerational families of children who are going into care because they have already been preempted.
Academic Dr. Rawiri Warisene Karina says the practice of taking babies from Māori has been going on far too long. He says the state is participating in the annihilation of Māoridom.
If you think about the UN definition of genocide, well, part of their process is the taking of babies and giving them to caregivers not of their culture. And so for me, what that actually means, if that's the definition of genocide, why is Orangatamariki or even this New Zealand government implicit in genocidal practices?
He says enough is enough.
Māori for Māori. We need to look after our own. And we have the, you know, the capacity, but aroha because they're ours.
MPs, including the acting Prime Minister Calvin Davis, briefly addressed the protest, which was met with shouting from the crowd. He said he supports the Minister for Children, Tracy Martin, and her mahi, and says she is making the changes that the protesters are asking for. Tracy Martin says changes that kicked in at the start of this month ensure the ministry must commit to its Treaty of Waitangi obligations and prioritise the whakapapa of children in their care.
Everything they are asking for, with regard to the fact that a government department cannot raise children, the fact that the best place for children is in loving families, all those things we don't disagree with.
Smaller protests were held in other centres today. In a statement, Orangatamariki says it acknowledges the protest action and it accepts that people feel strongly about these issues.
Marnie Dunlop with that report from Tuesday's Checkpoint programme. The government is playing down the prospect of job losses in the wake of its decision to can 11 industry training organisations and amalgamate all 16 polytechnics into one institution. The changes, which begin in April next year, are aimed at improving New Zealand's system of apprenticeships and skills training and securing the future of the often challenged polytechnic sector. They'll put the National Polytechnic in charge of on-the-job training and give industry-driven councils the power to veto courses they don't like. Our education correspondent, John Gerritsen, has been looking at the reaction to the announcement. He joined Susie Ferguson on Friday's Morning Report.
Now, and a big amalgamation here, this is about driving efficiencies, so surely there is going to be job losses here.
Look, absolutely, without doubt. There's 13,000 people working just in the polytechnics alone, and then you've got people also working for industry training organisations, which, as we know, are going to be phased out over the next couple of years. So there's bound to be job losses. The extent of them is not known. Now, the government's been at pains to say, look, there's not going to be a lot of job losses in the short term, and job cuts are not the aim of this whole exercise. They're going to be efficiencies, so yes, some people will go, but they're also hoping to increase the number of people in training by making the skills training system simpler, easier to enrol in, and therefore you'll need more staff.
How would you describe the reaction that you've been hearing from the sector?
Yeah, well, polytechnics have been interesting. I mean, no one's describing it really as a disaster, with perhaps one exception. And most are talking about, look, we see opportunities in this. I know Manukau Institute of Technology said, look, a national polytechnic streamlined apprenticeship system, that's going to be good for people in South Auckland. You know, one of the smallest institutes, Western Institute of Technology in Taranaki, were absolutely unequivocal. They said this is a good thing. It's overdue, should have been done years ago. But then you look at someone like Southern Institute of Technology down there in Southland, they're not happy. They've been arguing for a long time. They want to keep their autonomy and they want more guarantees around that. There is a bit of a select committee process to go through, and we'll see what comes out of that. But initially, at least, all the 16 institutes of technology, will be subsidiaries to this one national organisation. So there'll certainly be some autonomy in the short term. What will be interesting to see is how much of that will be maintained over the years.
What about the industry training organisations?
Yeah, they're absolutely disappointed. They really wanted to keep what's really been their core role, I guess, of organising and overseeing on-the-job training and apprenticeships. But it's interesting, they're not actually predicting disaster here. You know, some of them had been when the proposals were first put out, but now they're being much more measured. And what they're saying is, yeah, okay, you've changed the system, we're going to change the system, but this will not work unless industry's on board. So I guess they're confident or hopeful that whatever changes are made, they're still going to have a key role. And of course, they do actually have one sort of change coming that will strengthen their arm. They're going to have the power of veto over courses that industry doesn't like. If they don't like it, if they think it's not up to scratch, it won't get funding. They don't have that power right now, so that's a significant change. And they can also impose a final exam, so that if you want to be a truck driver or whatever, you know, you must reach a certain level as proved by this exam nationally, which is another big change.
All right, so is this overhaul going to work, and what are the costs of it?
Yeah, look, time will tell. It is a huge change, and the government, we're looking at cabinet papers that could cost as much as $400 million. The government says it's already put aside just under $200 million in contingency funding. So some of that's for the transition with the polytechnics, other changes also to be made by the Tertiary Education Ministry, Tertiary Education Commission and the Ministry of Education. But whether it works, yeah, we've really got to wait a few years to see.
So this National Polytechnic, it's already got itself into a bit of trouble, hasn't it?
Yeah, that's right. Look, last night I found that the name that they've provisionally assigned to this institute, the New Zealand Institute of Skills and Technology, is already taken. Now, government does say it's just a provisional name, but it was registered with the company's office back in February by someone who owns a private institute called the New Zealand Institute of Fashion and Technology. They decided to change that name to Skills and Technology, and yes, they will put that name up for sale if the government wants to buy it.
That's our education correspondent John Gerritsen on Morning Report. A random sample looking at the security of stolen firearms showed nearly a third were taken from unattended vehicles, most of which were left unlocked. The police study looked at 20% of all gun thefts over a two-year period and showed the majority were aided by the lax security measures of gun owners. Here's our police reporter Ben Strang.
In the 2 years up to July 2018, there were 672 stolen firearms reports received by police. They looked at a random sample of 133 reports, which showed whether licensed gun owners were complying with their security requirements. Those numbers are published in the minutes of the Firearms Community Advisory Forum, which met in March, and according to those notes,
62% were non-compliant with the conditions or the security requirements, and 32% were stolen when left unattended in vehicles.
What's more, the police say the majority of those vehicles had been left unlocked, and some owners even left their keys in the car. The police say it is incredibly concerning that the storage of stolen firearms was inadequate in so many cases. They say ammunition was also stolen in 40% of cases, which indicates that wasn't being stored safely either. Police would not agree to be interviewed, but in a statement they say,
"We do know from the sample review that far too many thefts are the result of inadequate storage and are therefore preventable. Police are able to initiate firearms licence revocation when a licence holder is found to not be meeting or is breaching the requirements of the Arms Act."
The president of the Police Association, Chris Cahill, says a 2016 select committee looked into gun security. It recommended firearms licences be revoked if the owner was found not to be complying with required security measures. That was rejected, but Mr Cahill says there should be a stronger system in place.
I actually think possibly there needs to be some carrot and stick here. So a first offence warning that's noted on the firearms owner that their security was breached or was inappropriate. They get a warning, but if it's repeated, then they should be subject to revocation.
The lobby group, the Council of Licensed Firearms Owners, also thinks people who aren't taking firearm security seriously should face serious punishment. Its secretary, Nicole McKee, says those who aren't complying should be dealt with.
We've heard of people leaving their firearms in their vehicle unlocked with even the keys in the vehicle. I mean, that's just not on. That's not the expectation of any firearms licence owner or police of those owners. But where we have instances of people who have been burgled when they've left the home and they've had entire walls ripped out they've done what they possibly could do to secure their firearms and should not be punished for the acts of a criminal.
Ms McKee disputes the police numbers on how many thefts involved lax security. She was at the advisory forum meeting and says police told her there were more than 1,100 gun thefts over the two-year period, of which just 81 involved poor security. She says that would prove the issue is minor and is not the main way guns make their ways into the hands of criminals.
I think that there have been some minor failings in security, and that has definitely been evidenced, but we do not believe it is the sole source of criminal access to firearms.
Chris Cahill disagrees, saying criminals obtaining stolen guns has been a problem for years.
There is no evidence of a large-scale illegal importations of firearms, so we know that they're coming from licensed firearms owners, and the need for them to be secure is really important.
Chris Cahill also suspects the number of thefts could be underreported, saying firearms owners whose poor security made the theft possible could be reluctant to go to the police for fear of the repercussions. Nicole McKee rejects that, saying gun owners are quick to call the police after a theft, regardless of whether they played a part.
That report from our police reporter Ben Strang from Tuesday's Morning Report. You're listening to The Week in Review. Still to come, a Northland GP is urging the DHB to publicly declare war on systemic racism. And Auckland Zoo's last remaining Sumatran tiger has been put down after a long illness.
You come to the zoo, you see a beautiful, beautiful tiger like Barani, and you realise that there's Barani's out there in the wild that are having a really, really hard time.
Still to come in The Week in Review. The feminist lobby group Speak Up for Women wants the government to step in over the disadvantaging of women and girls in sport. They're seeking public support for the move to restrict who can compete in women's sport, asking people to get in touch with Grant Robertson, the Minister for Sport and Recreation, about excluding trans athletes. Annie O'Brien is with Stand Up for Women. She joined Corin Dan on Morning Report.
Is it a bit dramatic to be asking the government to intervene here when there's... As I say, this is a pretty minor issue, isn't it?
No, the policies have actually only changed recently. So back in the early 2000s was when the Olympics first decided to allow trans women to compete in women's competitions. But back then it was dependent on a full surgical transition. And it's only a couple of years ago now that was reversed, and now it's just dependent on testosterone levels. And so coming into the 2020 Olympics, it's really the first time we're going to see more numbers of trans women competing in women's sport. And as we can see coming through age groups all around the world, it is becoming more prevalent as it has become easier to qualify for competitions.
But if that trans athlete is a woman... They're a trans woman and the testosterone levels are met, then that's their right to compete.
I would disagree with that. So, first of all, I'd like to assert that if they just have to reduce their testosterone to a level that's still usually around 6 to 12 times higher than an average female, that doesn't take into account the fact that... they have gone through puberty as a male. They've had the benefits of testosterone their whole life. In the example of Laurel Hubbard, only transitioning in their late 30s. Yeah,
but isn't there a case of, you know, when you've got Caster Semenya, the runner, who is a woman, biological, born a woman, yet she has a genetic condition which has given her heightened levels of testosterone, and that has caused issues for her. Surely there's just a level. If you get under the level... We live in a world now where a trans woman is a woman, that's what it says on their birth certificate, then it would be a breach of their human rights, wouldn't it? And that's why the IOC has allowed them in.
First of all, we disagree that intersex people should be, I guess, compared to trans people, because it's two very different things. And we definitely think that the IOC and other sporting bodies need to make sure that they tread very carefully around intersex athletes.
But aren't we just talking about, say for boxing, right, you've got to be a certain weight and then you fight someone else as a certain weight. And the IOC, and I understand they're lowering the testosterone levels, they've recognised that testosterone is something and they've said, right, we're going to get this level right. If you meet that, Then I just, what is the issue?
It's not right, though. So they're lowering it to 5 nanomoles, where most women aren't even 1 nanomole. So they're still going to be 5 times.
What about athletic women who are, you know, we're not talking about the average woman, are we? We're talking about elite sports people. So it's got to be a different level, doesn't it?
They're not allowed to dope with testosterone, so they would have the same kind of average levels of testosterone in their body, because as women competing, it's illegal in sport to dope. So they would have standard levels of testosterone in their bodies.
There is a fundamental human rights tension here, though, isn't there?
There is. So our argument is that in the Human Rights Act, Section 49, says nothing shall prevent the exclusion of persons of one sex from participation in any competitive sporting activity in which strength, stamina, or physique of competitors is relevant. So that is being completely ignored. And we would like the government to, I guess, work with the sporting organisations to look at how...
Sure, but in the end, though, if this is an IOC decision, there's nothing the government can do about that. It's not their right. So New Zealand government can't tell the International Olympic Committee how to set its rules.
No, but they can talk to local organisations. So we've talked to a lot of sporting organisations in the last little while, and the common thread is that they know it's unfair and that they are hamstrung by social and political consequences that they're fearful of from making any changes.
Okay.
So we're asking Grant Robertson to show a bit of leadership and alleviate their anxiety so a conversation can happen about this. Whereby we can actually look at the evidence, look at the science, rather than the ideology.
That's Annie O'Brien from Stand Up For Women on Tuesday's Morning Report. AUT is denying the Chinese government pressured it into cancelling a booking for an event marking the 30th anniversary of the bloody crackdown on protests in Tiananmen Square in Beijing. The university has confirmed it canned the room reservation after a request from China's vice consul general, but says it only did so because the booking did not follow the right process. The Tertiary Education Union says that doesn't sound credible. Again, here's our education correspondent, John Gerritsen.
Messages obtained by Newsroom under the Official Information Act show the 30th anniversary commemoration was cancelled after the Chinese consulate in Auckland contacted the university opposing the event. Emails show AUT's Vice-Chancellor, Derek McCormick, reminded the consulate that academic freedom was important, but in this instance, their concerns and AUT's concerns had coincided. Today, he told Checkpoint the Chinese brought the event to the university's attention, but did not threaten repercussions if it failed to act.
The Vice-Consul General pointed out that we had a good relationship with China, that we had lots of Chinese students, and he hoped that because of that good relationship we could help them out and cancel something that they objected to. So again, we didn't know what it was.
Mr. McCormick says the university looked into the booking and cancelled it because it was not made properly.
It needs to be done in the proper manner for all sorts of reasons, including health and safety. There are also charges that are made for rooms because of cleaning and setup and utilities. These things were bypassed by the person who made the booking. In fact, they did not even make the booking in their own name. So it was something that was completely out of order.
Mr. McCormick says AUT recently hosted a film screening the Chinese government had objected to, and if the reservation had been made correctly, the Tiananmen Square event would have gone ahead. The National Secretary of the Tertiary Education Union, Sian Riggs, says universities sometimes run into problems with room bookings, but she's dubious about AUT's excuse.
Hardly seems credible, does it? I mean, that is the public position that the university is putting out, but I guess from our point of view, that seems like a fairly lame reason to have cancelled the event. I guess our view would be that it's not dealing with the underlying issues of relationships with foreign governments.
Ms. Riggs says universities are too reliant on tuition fees from Chinese students.
When so many of our universities now are reliant on the fees that international students pay, and, you know, in AUT's case, it's quite a significant chunk of their annual income, it's inevitable that foreign governments are going to have the ability to put pressure on institutions should they want to, and I think in this case that's exactly what the Chinese government has done.
The government's relationship with China has been under scrutiny all year, and today the Education Minister, Chris Hipkins, said freedom of expression was not negotiable.
The relationship with China and with the Chinese government is very important to the New Zealand government. It's very important to a number of the tertiary education institutions in New Zealand. But that's always got to be on the basis of mutual respect and mutual respect for the values of the other country. And in New Zealand, free speech, the right to democratic protest, those are very important things to New Zealanders. And we've always been very clear with the Chinese government that those are things that we will always defend here in New Zealand.
Mr. Hipkins would not pass judgment on AUT's decision, but it appears that institutes that take Chinese students' money may also face pressure from their government. RNZ has approached the Chinese consulate for comment, but has not received a response.
That report from our education correspondent John Gerritsen on Tuesday's Checkpoint programme. A Northland GP is urging the DHB to publicly declare war on systemic racism. Kyle Eggleton says the Auckland DHB has led the way by admitting institutional racism is a barrier to Māori health and vowing to eliminate it. He says Northland DHB has the highest percentage of Māori patients and is silent. Our Northland reporter Lois Williams filed this for Friday's Morning Report.
In his PhD thesis, Kyle Eggleton researched the reasons behind the damning health stats for Māori in the North, and he came to the conclusion that unconscious bias has a lot to do with it, both at health board and GP level.
For example, Māori are probably less likely to be prescribed cholesterol-lowering medication if they've been diagnosed with heart disease. They're less likely to get the appropriate cancer treatment and the appropriate length of time. Less likely to be prescribed appropriate medications for infections.
These days, Kyle Eggleton works for a Māori health provider, Kia Ora Ngāti Wai. But he first woke up to bias based on race when he worked in a general practice and decided to audit his own prescribing. He was confident he'd come out squeaky clean, but he was wrong. He found he was much less likely to prescribe cholesterol-lowering drugs to Māori heart patients than to Pākehā.
I came to conclusions that I was making assumptions about people. So I would kind of think, well, you're less likely to take your medication because you're Māori, and that was a false thought. So it really, we have to challenge our own thinking in order to change our behaviours.
Dr. Eggleton says the same assumptions lurk in the systems of the District Health Board. He says Māori health providers don't get to design the programs the DHB believes will help their people. The contracts imposed on them are often short-term and overly monitored compared with Pākehā providers, and the nurses working for them are paid only 75% of what they'd earn at the DHB itself. He says the results are continuing high rates of third world diseases like rheumatic fever and early death for Māori.
Every kind of like health condition you can think of, there's inequity, and that's been persistent. So whatever the DHB's have done hasn't actually changed things.
The chair of the DHB, Sally McCauley, believes that's unfair. She says the board's made great strides in addressing the Māori health stats, including most recently pulling together the region's two primary health organisations, Manaia and Te Tai Tokerau, to focus on exactly that.
I'm actually quite surprised because Northern DHB focus heavily on our Māori who we love and want to ensure that their health is as good as anybody's, and we provide the very, very best service for them and access to services.
The DHB's General Manager for Māori Health, Harold Wedita, took on the job in 2016. He says the board's Chief Executive, Nick Chamberlain, gave compelling evidence to the recent Waitangi Tribunal inquiry into Māori health inequities, and he says his Māori health team has worked diligently to eliminate any racial bias at the DHB, starting with a program on engaging with Māori, compulsory for all staff.
We've also got other programs like the Treaty of Waitangi program, which talks about the foundation of our relationship with the iwi up here. We've had a very good response from clinicians, nurses, as well as staff in allied health and the administration side of the organisation.
Harold Wedita says some of the worst Māori health outcomes are showing signs of improving, but the problem of lower paid nurses in Māori organisations is one the board needs to tackle. And he says maybe it is time the Northland DHB went public about racial bias in health services, because that would reflect the mahi it's already doing to stamp it out.
Lois Williams with that report from Morning Report. The Prime Minister has come under fire for the timing of her trip to Tokelau as tensions continue at Ihumato in South Auckland. The Māori land dispute has divided political parties, with Simon Bridges now calling Jacinda Ardern a part-time Prime Minister over her decision to leave New Zealand at a critical time. Our political reporter Joe Moyer has the story.
On the eve of her trip to Tokelau, Jacinda Ardern went to Auckland and met with some of those involved in the Ihumato conflict and announced any building development at the site would be halted until a resolution could be found. Simon Bridges says the Prime Minister shouldn't have got involved.
She's put herself right in it, and as I say, where is she? She's gone on a trip for days to Tokelau, 1,500 people. Well, every MP has a street in New Zealand, which she hasn't visited, that has many more people than that. And look, whether it's the stalling economy, whether it's Ihumato, or whether it is a bunch of other issues, she's showing herself at the moment, and the government's showing itself to be a part-time Prime Minister and government.
Mr Robertson questioned what exactly Mr Bridges was getting at with his part-time dig of Ms Ardern.
And I don't quite know what Simon Bridges was saying when he said the phrase part-time Prime Minister. I do wonder if there's a bit of a sexist overtone in that.
Mr Bridges says everyday New Zealanders should be the priority.
I said at our National Party conference that my bottom line is you. Everyday New Zealanders who are struggling because of what this government's doing to economy, who've got issues with housing, a land occupation that the Prime Minister has sparked off, and she's gone off to Tokelau. She clearly isn't focused on the issues that matter to New Zealanders.
The backwards and forwards spat flowed into question time, where Mr Robertson challenged Mr Bridges on what he meant by everyday New Zealanders.
The Prime Minister believes that all New Zealanders deserve to see their Prime Minister once in a while. And unlike the previous government, we're not going to ignore the people of Tokelau, nor are we going to behave in such a disrespectful way as the Leader of the Opposition has by suggesting that Tokelauans are not everyday New Zealanders. What did you mean by that, Mr Bridges?
While Ms Ardern and the Labour Māori caucus are backing Mana Whenua to resolve the issue, Mr Bridges says Nationals taking Te Kawero's side. New Zealand First is also backing the mandated iwi, and Regional Economic Development Minister Shane Jones took aim at what the protesters were wearing when speaking to Radio Wātea this morning.
Look, I've got zero tolerance when I saw some of the personalities out there dressed up in yoga pants. They don't speak for Mana Whenua, and they don't, in my view, represent the long-term interests of Māori traditional leadership.
Asked by RNZ what yoga pants had to do with it, this was his response.
Oh, well, a lot of those people, they're only interested in iwi politics when it accords with their far-left views. And I don't see why they should be given any legitimacy at all within the treaty settlement process. They should all pack up their freedom camping gear and go home.
The Green Party has been at Ihumato in support of the protesters and is blaming a flawed treaty settlement process for the current mess. Greens co-leader Marama Davidson wouldn't say whether Ms Ardern should have stayed in New Zealand to sort it out. Ms Ardern arrives back on Thursday night, but there's no word yet on whether she will visit Ihumato on her return.
That's our political reporter Joe Moyer from Tuesday's Checkpoint programme. Vodafone is stealing a march on its rivals by unveiling plans to roll out the next generation of mobile communications in New Zealand in December. 5G is held up as a giant leap forward in delivering near-instant internet on mobile devices, but it won't come cheap. Customers will need a new device and will have to pay more for the service. Our business reporter Madison Reedy has the details.
That isn't your typical haka. That was a hologram delivered through a 5G network. A network that's about to be rolled out by Vodafone in Auckland, Wellington, Christchurch and Queenstown come December. That means Vodafone has officially won the race to introduce 5G in this country. Vodafone's chief executive, Jason Paris, is pretty chuffed.
Others have been talking about it. We've been doing it. We're really excited about the opportunities we've seen internationally. We've rolled out 5G in Italy, Spain, Germany and the UK. We can see that customers are enjoying it, but we can really see that it's transforming businesses. And we want to make sure that New Zealand businesses maintain their competitive advantage, so we've brought 5G forward.
The 5G mobile network is expected to be up to 10 times faster than the existing 4G. It has less lag time and enables new technology like higher resolution video and holographic phone calls like this one.
Tony, let's have a crack at this and see.
Vodafone's been secretly working away on the new network for about 6 months, but has kept it under wraps until today. Mr. Parris says it's been able to accelerate its plan to launch 5G since securing new owners, who've bought the New Zealand business for $3.4 billion.
Today is also day one of a brand new Vodafone. We've got long-term investors in Brookfield and Infratil, so we're bringing Vodafone New Zealand home, closer to New Zealand, and because of our new owners' belief in this strategy and belief in this organisation, they have allowed us to pull forward this investment and launch it earlier than we intended to.
Over the next 5 months, Vodafone will spend tens of millions of dollars transitioning 120 of its cell sites to 5G and upgrading about 400 of its 4G sites. Some critics think that suggests this is just a 4G facelift, not the full Monty 5G. The chief executive of the Telecommunications Users Association, Craig Young, is in that camp.
Technology across the world, we're seeing a number of these telecommunications companies launching what they're calling 5G, when the actual standards for 5G mobile technology have actually yet to be finalised. And so what we're seeing is companies like Vodafone launching using technology that's available at the moment, which is as close to 5G as they can get with the standards that are in place at the moment and with what regulatory authorities such as New Zealand will let them do. So it will be some time since we see the full impact of what we're calling 5G.
But no matter the detail, Vodafone's launch means it's stolen a march on its New Zealand rivals. Spark planned to be the first to launch a 5G network, but hit speed bumps when the GCSB blocked it from using equipment from China's Huawei in its rollout. Spark doesn't seem too deflated, though. Here's what its chief executive, Jolly Hodson, had to say on Twitter.
Good to see Vodafone New Zealand and Jason Parris joining Spark on the journey to 5G. We've felt like the lone voice over the last couple of years, so it's pleasing to see our competitors stepping up on this important new technology for New Zealand.
The launch signals a new beginning for Vodafone New Zealand. Its previous leaders took a back seat on 5G, saying that after being the first to launch 2G, 3G and 4G in New Zealand, they'd wait and see with the fifth edition. They were distracted with other things, such as preparing the company to list on the New Zealand Stock Exchange.
We haven't been in a position as Vodafone New Zealand probably over the last 3 or 4 years to place big bets like this. When opportunities have come up, we haven't been in a position to make the most of them. Put a new plan in place in December last year. The organisation, it's been well publicised, has made some really tough choices. And what those tough choices have meant is that now we have confidence and we've created the room for us to make these types of investments. And we've got owners that will back us to make that investment as well.
It seems that Vodafone is now meeting its own motto, that the future is exciting. But possibly not so exciting for customers who'll have to pay a premium for 5G and buy new devices to use it.
That's our business reporter, Madison Reedy, from Tuesday's Checkpoint program. A Whanganui migrant advocate says local Māori should concentrate on dragging themselves out of poverty rather than worrying about the small number of refugees due to be resettled in the city. But others say an iwi leader who wants the city's housing crisis to be sorted before refugees are welcomed has a point. Our Taranaki Whanganui reporter Robin Martin has more.
Whanganui was chosen as a refugee resettlement destination in February. About 30 refugees or 3 to 5 families are due to arrive from April next year, and up to 110 refugees are expected every year thereafter. Whanganui Tupuhu iwi leader Ken Mayer disrupted an Immigration New Zealand meeting in the city earlier this week. Mr. Mayer says iwi have not been properly consulted on the resettlement program, and local Māori who are suffering poor housing and ill health should be the district's first priority. But the president of the Multicultural Council of Rangitike and Whanganui, Pushpa Prasad, says Māori should stop looking for handouts.
We are chucking money in a leaky bucket or in a bottomless pit. Never mind how much you dump in there, still won't be enough. Unless people stand up by themselves and go and start fetching things for themselves or looking after themselves. That's how I look at it.
Whanganui-based, Ms. Prasad moved to New Zealand from Fiji about 30 years ago. She says the city is putting in the work and will be prepared to accept the refugees next year, housing crisis or not.
I think they are ready. I don't see any reason why they shouldn't, they cannot be. You know, housing shortage and all these issues are all over the country. It's everywhere. And if we make a little bit of room for people who need support and help, I don't think we are going to lose too much.
According to Real Estate Institute figures, median house prices in Whanganui are at a record $295,000, up 25% on a year earlier. Managing Director of Landlords Link, Tracy Onoshenko, says rents have shot up off the back of investor interest in the city.
Rents have skyrocketed. I do think some of them are over the top for what you're getting. I mean, the average three-bedroom now would be about $350 to $370. So that's a lot of money for a lot of people.
Ms. Onoshenko thinks Mr. Mayor has a point.
I think he does because, I mean, at the end of the day, I mean, we're going to be worried about the refugees coming here, and if they're not going to have paid employment and they're not going to find it hard to live, like, where are they going to live? The people here that are employed, they're struggling. You know, then they're getting probably okay money. They're struggling to secure a house.
There are 529 state houses in Whanganui. According to the Ministry of Housing and Urban Development, in March, 96 applicants for housing were waiting on the housing register. In the same month, it paid out about $9,000 in emergency housing grants to 16 applicants. The manager of the Whanganui Budgetary Advisory Service, Sandy Fage, says there is no doubt that the city is in the midst of a housing crisis.
We have clients that are living in sheds, garages. Yeah, we've got a couple, and one's living in a truck. We've got numerous clients who have been told that they're on the Housing New Zealand waiting list, so they've actually gone through the process and meet the criteria, but they're still stuck on the waiting list.
Ms. Fage says a lot of her clients are working, and it is not unusual for them to be paying 85% of their incomes in rent. She can see where Mr. Mayor is coming from.
Adding pressure to a pressure point is probably not a good thing, but I believe in a diverse community, so, you know, It's a bit of a tricky situation to actually say what's the right thing to do.
Whanganui District Councillor Philippa Baker-Hogan has questioned whether Whanganui is ready to host refugees.
I'm clear that our priority, and I believe council, but our priority is dealing with what really is our own housing crisis.
Ms. Baker-Hogan says the council has been finalising its housing strategy this week and says it has a glaring omission.
The truth is there have been no actual iwi submissions to this housing strategy, and yet we know a lot of the issues around the housing crisis are with Māori people and their people, but that I believe, and I pointed out, council needs to really engage at a partnership level. Iwi, in my view, shouldn't have to submit to our strategy necessarily. Our discussions with them need to be at a real relationship partnership level.
Ms. Baker-Hogan says council has passed a resolution on Tuesday to seek out iwi input on the strategy.
That report from our Taranaki Whanganui reporter Robin Martin, as heard on Thursday's morning report. Auckland Zoo's last remaining Sumatran tiger has been put down after a long illness. 11-year-old Barani was part of an international breeding program for the endangered species and was born with two siblings who were sent across the Tasman to Sydney. Their mother died last year, and since then Barani has been on his own. Team leader of carnivores at Auckland Zoo, Lauren Booth, was with Barani from the day he was born. In a sense, this is a love story. And at times, through tears, she told Alex Perrette on Checkpoint his illness had got worse lately and they had run out of options.
Unfortunately, it was a type of condition that is very, very hard to diagnose and then even more difficult to treat. And we had unfortunately reached the point where there was nothing else possible that we could try for him, and so due to decrease in his welfare as part of this disease, we had to make the decision to euthanize him, which was really devastating for us, as you can imagine.
Yeah, and I guess there's an idea out there. I mean, I know that tigers can live much longer than Barani lived for, and maybe that plays into people's minds in terms of that idea that these animals in zoos don't really realise their full potential. What do you say to that in terms of Barani's life?
Yeah, so most animals in captivity do live much longer than they would in the wild, and it is unfortunate that Barani, due to his gastrointestinal disease that he did have, that he did die younger than he would have. But I guess what I would say is that it's very similar to people. I mean, we also should live a lot longer than some of us should live a lot longer, or we think we should live a lot longer than we do. But unfortunately, we face the same types of illnesses as well, to a great degree, and they just manifest themselves differently. So it's just like people. Some of us go before our time as well.
Now, Barani had a couple of siblings, and they were sent away, and then his mother died not so long ago as well. Are tigers social? I mean, you said they're a bit like humans. Humans are social. I know chimpanzees are, and zoos always try to get the right mix and make sure that they grow together and can live together. Did Barani need more friends around him?
So tigers are solitary by nature, so they don't require the same social structure as many other species, as you mentioned, like chimpanzees, for example.
Mm-hmm.
But he had lived with his mother from a very young age, and we were able to manage them in together. We were quite lucky to be able to do that. But they, you know, they had their own space within that environment, even though they did have a relationship, a close relationship. So, yeah, they're a bit of a different situation compared to, say, your chimpanzees or other social species.
So what's the zoo going to do now? Because you've been building a new tiger enclosure and you just lost your last tiger. Are you on the lookout for a replacement?
So as part of our long-term plan, even obviously while Barani was still with us, and we were expecting him to be with us into the future to this new exhibit, but as part of that we were looking at acquiring more tigers to share that space with him. So that's still on the cards, and that's still something we're planning for in the future.
And why do we need to have tigers in zoos? People take interest in the overall tiger numbers. They've been scaling down and they are endangered. Although I think in recent years, I think worldwide numbers may have I think the graph might be turning around, but it's still a concern. I mean, how is it important in terms of the work that the zoo does with tigers?
So in regards to Sumatran tigers, they're still considered critically endangered and their population trend is still decreasing. There are as few as 400 left in the wild, which means things are pretty dire out there for them. And if there aren't places like Auckland Zoo who are raising awareness and also raising funds to send to places like Wildcats Conservation Alliance to support the conservation work out there in the wild, things are really not looking good for tigers or for Sumatran tigers. A great example of this is the anti-poaching units that Auckland Zoo support through Wildcats Conservation Alliance. Where those anti-poaching units operate, tiger numbers are stabilising and increasing, but if there are no funds for those units, then tiger numbers are going to be hit really, really hard. And it is estimated that if numbers keep decreasing in Sumatra the way that they are, they could be extinct in the wild within the next 10 years. And so that's our lifetime. And no one wants that, because you come to the zoo, you see a beautiful, beautiful tiger like Barani, and you realise that, you know, there's Baranis out there in the wild that are having a really, really hard time, and we've got to do what we can to save them. And by helping connect our visitors with these animals, we can actually secure a future for tigers in the wild, and hopefully none of us will ever have to live in a world without tigers.
So, Lauren, you're obviously very, very connected to Barani, and it's all still very fresh. Maybe we can finish with perhaps your fondest memory of Barani.
My fondest memory of Barani? Probably something really, really simple. I just love the way that you could come in the mornings, and sometimes you'd call him inside for his breakfast, and he'd just be... He'd just be like, why don't you come inside for breakfast? But he'd just be out sitting up on a platform, just looking out over the zoo and just taking in the sights and the sounds. And he just would have this look on his face, these slightly sleepy eyes and this big fluffy face, and just looking so regal and content and just so, so handsome and, it's hard to put into words. It's just his whole persona, completely dignified and adorable, because you knew that he also was incredibly goofy, and it was just that you know, almost contradiction in his personality. It was, just the awe that he could inspire, even in someone like myself who had the privilege of working with him, you know, every day from pretty much the day he was born. You just can never, you never lose that sense of awe, and that's what I think I love the most about working with him.
Team leader of carnivores at Auckland Zoo, Lauren Booth, who was with Barani, the Sumatran tiger, from the day he was born. Barani was put down this week after a long illness, and she was speaking on Tuesday's Checkpoint program. New Zealand's greatest equestrian, Sir Mark Todd, has announced his retirement. 63-year-old Todd won 2 individual gold medals from the Olympic Games, 4 badminton titles, 5 Burley crowns and 2 world championship team titles. Todd, who was named the rider of the 20th century, retired after the Sydney Olympics in 2000, but returned to competition in 2008. He's been thinking about retirement for a while, and as he's been getting back into racehorse training, he felt the time to make the change was now. Todd told sports reporter Barry Guy his decision wasn't about age, as he still felt competitive.
I still feel really good, and I actually still enjoy the competition as well, but it's not just about the competition. You need to be focused and driven to be successful, and I just found my focus was taken away from that, and I think if you're not 100% focused in a dangerous sport, then it's not a good thing to be keeping going. But I still will be involved in a couple of programs I have with younger riders, and so I won't be totally walking away from it. It's been a big part of my life for a long time.
It certainly has, and you look back on your career and there's pretty much nothing that you haven't achieved.
Well, I never won an individual world championship. I went close a couple of times. But no, you know, I've been, honestly, I've been very fortunate. And, you know, I've had an amazing career, way more than I ever imagined I could. And it's certainly gone on a lot longer than I ever thought it would as well.
And for so many years, you were linked with the charisma. You know, the two names sort of went together. That must have been a remarkable number of years that, you know, you were together.
Yeah, no, well, he was a horse that sort of firmly put me on the map. And, you know, he still ranks as probably the one horse that I'm most associated with, and the horse that, you know, was probably my horse of a lifetime, if you ever have one, certainly in eventing. And, you know, I owe him a lot.
So you, emotionally, I mean, are you sort of happy, relieved, sad? How are you feeling?
Well, a mixture of both. I'm pretty sad that it's all come to an end, but I'm also sort of relieved that I've finished in one piece.
Sir Mark Todd talking to Barry Guy on Monday's Morning Report. And finally in the Week in Review, Baldwin Street's battle to be recognised as the world's steepest street isn't over yet. Last month, Guinness World Records stripped it of the title and awarded it to a Welsh street, Fjord Pen Llec. But Dunedin surveyor Toby Stoff says the way Guinness measured the streets wasn't up to professional standards, and he's begun what he hopes is a new record-restoring survey. He joined Corin Dan on Thursday's Morning Report.
So what's the crux of your case here that you're going to put up?
The crux is just that the measurement of the Welsh Street was taken on the inside of a horizontal curve and not on the centre line, where all the design manuals and all the highway manuals say that, you know, where gradients should be shown on long sections and these sorts of things. So it's not a survey issue. It's just like it's a technical issue.
All right. So if you were to take it from, well, we don't know. Do you know if they've taken any, what would it be if you were able to redo it? Do you know, do you have a sense?
I can take a punt, because we did like a bit of a test case in Dunedin. They had 37.45 on the centre line of this curve. We did one around Lancefield Street. I think we had 33%. But we dropped down to 19% as you went from the outside to the inside. So, I mean, listen, here's the deal. If you're designing a road and you're doing a road long section and you're showing road gradients, it's done on the centre line. Like the centre line is your fundamental component for your design. So that's what you hinge all your templates off, and that's what you use to create the shape of the road. You know, the design standards that we use, we use Ostroads road design guidelines.
Well, surely the Guinness World, they must have a standard.
They do. They do, and they've got their parameters, which is okay. Minimum length of 10 meters, which is totally fine. I can see where they're at. There, you know, they don't want it just like a pothole qualifying you for the steeper street. So you've got to qualify the minimum length. But I'm saying, well, you need to do it on the centre line. You can't just shift from, like, let's say they curve from left to right, then right to left. They'd be jumping to the left, then jumping to the right, then jumping to the left. If you're doing a road long section, you prepare it. You show the centre line finish level, and that's what you use to show your road gradients.
Do you think the Welsh have pulled a bit of a swifty here?
They have pulled out the charm by it. They've pulled out a real awesome charm offensive. And look, to be honest with you, I like the guys. You know what I mean? They look awesome. And I've been messaging the... Sarah Branham? We had good bands the other night. She responded, she said, yeah, come on over, have a measure. I said, mate, I'm not measuring anything. If I'm coming to Wales, I'll come and check out your castles and yarn with the locals, you know what I mean? They sound like an awesome bunch. So the issue is, you know, I think they've turned on the charm offensive. They've lobbied really well. And let's be honest with you, I mean, Guinness isn't doing this for the good of their health, are they? You know what I mean? You can't say they're totally...
Well, that opens up an opportunity for you, though, doesn't it? Because then why wouldn't they be open to hearing your case? So were you need to do a counter-charm offensive?
Funny you should mention that, Corinne, because I got a response after 2 weeks yesterday, and I think you might just squeak in front of Damien Newell. We recorded a thing yesterday, but here's their reply. I sent them like a pretty detailed sort of a thing. I said, boys, you got it wrong. Here's all the design guys say you should do. Dear Toby, thank you for your inquiry. Your points are very much appreciated. Further details, blah, blah, blah. Here's a link to the press request. Oh, you go jump in the lake, mate. And so the issue we got here is, you know, we've got a battle of maybe charm and public sentiment versus technical.
You need a little social media campaign. You need something that can fire things up, surely.
I'm not the guy for that, mate. I'm a technical guy. I'm a computer nerd. I just sit in front of a computer screen and design roads all day. That's what I do. That's where my strengths are. But
the thing is, my recollection from the interviews we did on this was that it wasn't Guinness's surveyors, was it?
No, it wasn't Guinness.
The Welsh got their own surveyor, and then it was verified.
Verified by someone from the local council. Well, that doesn't exactly sound.
Sounds like a super overrule to me.
What's that?
Sounds like a super overrule to me.
Oh God, yeah. Oh, don't. Well, that was the thing, eh? Like, if it had happened 2 weeks later, I might not have been quite so bent out of shape. But the day after we lost the Cricket World Cup, oh my God, yeah, I did a full John McEnroe. It was quite funny, but
which is interesting, isn't it? Because it does, you know, for those perhaps in other parts of the country, it suggests that this actually did hurt for Dunedin, and it does matter.
Yeah, well, this is the deal. Like, we've got so much, like the media's been real interested in it, and, you know, we're getting a lot of real positive feedback. You know, good job, mate, you know what I mean? And I didn't approach anyone, you know what I mean? It was just my mate Tim Brown. I just happened to mention it to him. He says, oh, Tim, I think they made a cock-up here. We need to bloody... I might write a sternly worded letter to the editor, and I thought that's about as far as it'll go. Then Tim goes, oh, hang on a sec, bro, I'll just make a few inquiries. Guinness says, no, you're right, they measured on the inside. So Tim did a wee article, then before you know it, Jim Morgan, oh, can I do a thing? Yeah, sweet. And then TVNZ, blah, 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 blah. And then before you know it, I think people are genuinely interested in this, eh? Because the deal is, okay, I think what we've got here is a very charming, you know, Welsh town. They've bought their A-game. They've bought the charm offensive. They've lobbied really well. They're really nice people, and I really like them. I think they're really cool. But now I'm saying, but what about Dunedin? We did nothing wrong. You took our report away unfairly.
That's Dunedin surveyor Toby Stoff speaking on Morning Report. And that ends this edition of The Week in Review. The next program will be available to download next Friday evening, New Zealand time. You can also catch up on the week's sporting highlights in the podcast Extra Time from RNZ Sport. All podcasts at rnz.co.nz. For now, from me, Paul Brennan, kia pai te wiki. Have a great week.